Thank you, Patricia. Good morning, everybody. The first session today is looking at the features, common features of rate regulation, which we spoke about in the July meeting when we met in July, trying to identify what are the common features of rate regulation and do they distinguish rate regulation from other general commercial activities. We have been using those features as the basis for our discussions with the IESB since the July meeting. And although we have a couple of sessions late in the day to update you on the two elements of our rate regulated activities project, both the interim standard and the main research project, I think it's probably worth setting some little context here before we get into our discussion of the features, and just to help us focus in. In October, the IESB looked at some of the rights and obligations that the staff have analysed as attaching to the features we talked about in July. Would have agreed at this stage that they will focus on a particular type of rate setting mechanism, which we have called in the agenda paper 2 for this meeting a dual adjustment, dual element adjustment mechanism. That's just a tentative decision to help us progress the project, because at this stage we think that gives us the clearest path to discussing whether rate regulation creates assets and liabilities. We may need to change that path at a later date, but that's where we're going at the moment. And I know one or two people have already mentioned this morning they've read the board paper that's been prepared for next week's ISD that gets into the analysis of assets and liabilities. The main purpose of this group is not to get into that discussion. That will be held with the ISD. We've got another meeting in December with the Accounting Standards Advisory Forum, which will also discuss the conceptual framework definitions of assets and liabilities and the features of rate regulation in that context. The main purpose of our discussion this morning is really to drill down into the features that have been identified that the IESB is using for their ongoing analysis, to make sure that we've properly analysed those features, we've properly identified the rights and obligations attached to those features, and whether you think that we've captured them well enough, whether you think we should change some of the priorities, whether you think there should be a different emphasis on some of those features, or whether you think there are some additional features that we haven't captured that you think are important. So that's really the focus of this morning's discussion. The board did ask us as well to check with this group the detail and the facts within the analysis that they're using, obviously to help give them confidence that they're on track and discussing the right sort of thing. Jesus has provided us with some slides, which we did distribute around the group, but we've also put hard copies on the desk in case anybody didn't get a chance to download them before this morning's meeting. And I am hoping that everybody will be able to contribute to the discussion this morning, but perhaps, Jesus, you might like to start the discussion and take people through the slides that you presented.
Okay, thank you very much, Jane, for giving me the opportunity to explain this. I think the paper I have prepared is the purpose of this paper is just to answer all the questions you have mentioned, or to discuss about the key features and trying to explain which is my opinion on the discussion that has been discussed during September and October ISD meeting. So I would like to begin with my conclusions. The main question, and then I will go through the paper. I have two conclusions. The first one, from my point of view, now the scope of the project, as is now proposed by the discussion with the ISB, is too narrow. I think, from my point of view, it should be broadened. But we have to discuss about that. And the second question is a conclusion of the first one. The first one is that finally this scope that is being proposed approved, from my point of view, very similar activities will have a very different accounting recognition criteria. So I think we have to discuss about this. So, as after putting on the table these two conclusions, we can go through the paper, because this paper is to elaborate more in depth this conclusion. So we can go to slide 3. What I had tried to do here is to analyze all the features that were discussed in the paper 9b of September of the ASB. And you had on the left the features, and on the right you have my views. So, in the first page, that is first, page 3, I had two comments. The first one is related, I think, where there was a discussion about related with the essential services. There was a discussion about inelasticity. And from my point of view, inelasticity or demand is a related concept. So depending on the price level, excessive tariffs could lead to lower consumption in every type of goods or services. I think it will depend on the level of prices if it's impacting demand or not. So it's very difficult, and especially if we are speaking about an accounting gap, to introduce this suggested cost concept of inelasticity. No? And the second comment I have here is when you are discussing about rate regulator, I want to point out that in the case of concession arrangements, the regulator normally is the same entity as the grantor of the concession. And normally, all regulations are not in a law, normally included in the contract, in the concession arrangement. So I think it's a question that has to be in mind, because I think it's you can have the regulator as a separate entity, and in the case of concessions, the regulator is the same entity that is the grantor, that is the part that's signing the contract. Okay, we go to slide 4. I think here we had the crucial discussion, from my point of view. It's a discussion, the point that, or the main feature that you are proposing, that dual element adjustment that is related with the discussion about deviations and also about true-up mechanisms with an automatic adjustment. So, also here on the right you have my views, and I have here 4 concerns. This is the point that I'm trying to explain here on the right in page 4. The first one is that from my point of view, and these are the reasons, because I understand the scope is too narrow. The first one is I understand that as now you are proposing the standard, it's only focused on deviation. So deviation that is past performance worse or better than expected, rather than on setting initial regulation. And my question is, why is initial regulation excluded from the scope? Because you have deviation in a regulation, but you have initial regulation of a new business. And you have also a question to discuss, can you recognize a regulatory asset in initial regulation? That's the first point. The second point is, you have been discussing about the true-up mechanism or automatic adjustment. And from my point of view, this type of mechanism is only a mechanism established in some type of regulations to reinforce the probability, and this is the main question, that cost will be recovered with future tariffs. But as is being discussed with the consensual framework discussion, from my point of view, probability is a question related to asset measurement, not related to recognition. So having a true-up mechanism and the type of true-up mechanism you have, from my point of view, is more related with measurement and not to recognition. So it's another question that we can discuss. The third question is, when you analyze different types of regulations, I understand the true-up mechanism differs from different types of activities. And you are analyzing one type of this type of adjustment, that this is the true-up mechanism that is an automatic adjustment that normally is done through deferral accounts. But I put in here other examples, and one example is, for example, in the law of a concession contract, you have what you say, the right to economic and financial balance of a concession. This means that it's a right that has normally the operator of a concession to receive a compensation in some cases when there are changes that have an impact in the economic in the economics of the project. For example, one of these reasons, and depend on the contract and depend on the country, the how this type of mechanism works. But for example, in some countries, if there is a decision from the government that has an impact in the economics of the concession, they will have the right to receive the compensation. For example, I'm using an example of a parallel road that is opened by the government when you're operating an operating road, a toll road, sorry. And another question, in some cases, the regulation analyzed deviations, but they consider the deviation not to recover the past deviations, but to consider in the future tariffs. So here the discussion is, there is different true-up mechanism, why this type of true-up mechanism is included and other true-up mechanisms are excluded. And finally, for me the key element here, and I think that it's a question that has been also discussed during the papers I had the opportunity to read in the ESB meetings in September and October, is the timing difference. I think the timing difference is a mismatch between you have costs. Normally, the costs are related to the service you are going to render, but normally are recognized for financial reporting as incurred and probably initially. And you have revenue related to that regulated activity that is affected by price regulation. And as it's affected by price regulation, there is a timing difference between that expenses and that revenue. So I think that key, that a timing difference is a key element that has to be considered in the definition of this type of activities. So, in order to illustrate this concern, in the slide 5, I have tried to use two examples. No? Yes. And the example A probably should be included now within the current scope. We are speaking about electricity transport company. I know I'm an expertise. I think there is a lot of people expertise, but so it's something I had trying to analyze. And suppose that due to the impact of hurricane, an electricity transport company, Company A, has incurred costs to repair and refurbish the infrastructure. This operating expenses, depreciation, cost of debt, taxes, etc. All these costs are going to be recovered in the next 10 years through a special tariff set by the regulator that will be charged to the customers depending on energy consumption. And the tariffs are based, in this case, in a true-up mechanism that recognizes an automatic adjustment for extra costs due to major climate effects. So, if we make the question, can the company here, under current draft scope, to recognize the assets? Probably the answer should be yes, because here we are speaking about true-up mechanism with automatic adjustment. And we go now to example B. Example B is the example of a toll road. It supports a government has decided to refurbish and to build new lanes in an existing road, which currently is congested, through a toll road electronic system. For this purpose, it signs a contract, it's a concession contract, with a private company, it's called the operator, that will build the new infrastructure, and after finishing construction, will incur costs. Also, we have the operating expenses, the depreciation of the investment, the cost of debt, and the taxes. And all these costs are going to be recovered in the next 10 years by charging tariffs to the users of the infrastructure. In this case, as in the other case, the tariffs are fixed by the government. He is the operator, in the other case, is the regulator, but it's finally the government. And the reason they are fixing the tariffs is to protect users from the dominant position of the operator, as there is not an alternative law. So it seems very similar, from my point of view, to the case A, or the example A, no? The only difference is the question that first, tariffs have not been fixed according to a true-up mechanism, are based not on deviations. We are not speaking here about deviation. We are speaking here about initial cost and investment. This is the first one, or the first, my first concern in relation with the proposal. And secondly, they are not using a true-up mechanism, but they have the right of a compensation, what I have called the right to the economic and financial balance. For example, in the case of the government decide to build an alternative free road. And probably if we make the same question, is can company be under current data scope to recognize an asset? Probably the answer should be no, because they don't have the two-part mechanism and they don't have deviations. And so my question is there any major difference between the two cases that justify the different recognition criteria? So, in my point of view, probably, because I'm not a specialist in all type of regulation, from my previous view, it doesn't seem to be a very major difference. But now, the conclusion could be, in example A, yes, in example B, no. To illustrate the samples, I have prepared also a very easy number that we have in slide 6 and 7. You have any questions? But in the case, when we finish, we can go through a question. But if you have any question now, write it through a specific question, we can go through. We have here the examples of example A and example B. I am trying to use the same number. We have cost of 120, a revenue that is established by the government through future tariffs of 130, and this means a rate on return of 8.3%. It's excluding time value of money because it's a very, very easy example. And you have on the left side the timing dash, the timing difference. You can see in the case of example A, expenses or the cost, you are incurring the cost during the initial years, but you are recovering that cost during the 10 years. So on the right side of the slide, you have, I suppose, which will be the regulatory asset and the evolution of the regulatory asset during the time. So you can see that here there is a big timing difference between cost and revenue. And in the sample B, you have the same example with the same figures, but on the left side, you have which is the evolution or the typical evolution of cost and revenues in this type of projects of toll roads. Normally, revenues are increasing, are growing during all the period, but expenses are reducing during the period. Why? Because normally tariffs are established in order to cover the problems of the users and the question that there is a monopoly and a dominant position. So, but at the end of the day, the same question is the timing difference. And on the right, you have the regulatory asset that should be probably smaller than in the former case because they have cost during all the life of the concession. But it seems to be something similar, no? So, the answer or the question here: can the company recognize the asset in case A or in case B? We can discuss it. And another question is: what will be the impact on future deviations in the case B? Probably you say no. The problem is that in case B you don't have that automatic adjustment. But I say, okay, I don't have the automatic adjustment, but it's a question of probability. So discuss the measurement, not discuss the recognition. So that's my point. Okay, so to finish, and after making this analysis, I proposing an alternative analysis or an alternative definition, trying to understand from my point of view which are the key features of these activities. And I am proposing four, and the last one is in the fifth is in the slide 9. So we go to slide 8. We had the first one. We had a company, a regulated entity, that renders or sells essential services or products. That energy, water, transport, infrastructure from a monopoly or dominant position is a key issue. Second one, we have a regulator supported by the legislation and probably or by any type of contract, for example, in the case of a concession or government regulations that approves or determines price that bind customers. This is the second key feature. And the third is related that price regulation covers an objective that is protect users from the monopoly or dominant position and establish quality and availability controls. And finally, also that price regulation is allowed regulated entities to recover costs and earn a fair return. So we have 4 points. The first one is monopoly or dominant position. The second one is regulator that determines price to bind customers. The third one, the reason of that regulation of prices is to protect users from that monopoly or dominant position, and the fourth one, there is a fair rate of return in this. So I think there's 4 key features of the activity from my point of view. And the fifth one is that it's an implication in terms of accounting is the timing difference. Due to this regulation, there is a timing difference to costs that normally are recognized as incurred and revenue related to the regulated activity that is affected by pre-regulation that is recognized when the underlying services are rendered. So, as there is that type of protection to the consumer, there is a timing difference. So, from my point of view, these 3 points should be the key features to be considered. And finally, if we go to slide 10, move on to slide 10, which is the accounting guidance needed from my point of view. I think the accounting guidance needed. It should be to answer 2 questions. The first one is, can a company under a regulated activity recognize a regulatory asset due to the tariffs that is going to receive in the future in order to compensate current costs and obtain a fair rate of return during the regulatory period? This is the main question, and from my point of view, it will be possible if you met the four key features mentioned in slide 8, and you have also that timing difference mentioned in slide 9. And the second question is, and this is probably the discussion we have now, will the recognition be affected by the existence of a type of truth-up mechanism? From my point of view, the answer should be no, because as I said before, according to the new consensus framework, project probability is not an issue of recognition. It's an issue of measurement. So, from my point of view, again, a system of no or true-up mechanism will support lower exposure to changes, but not a restriction to asset recognition. So, finally, if there is a change in probability, probably a regulated activity that has this type of automatic adjustment will not have changes in estimates. But if it's a project that has any type of risk, for example, demand risk or other risk, they will have the change on estimates, and probably they have the risk to having a loss of other recognition of the asset in the future. But again, I think this is a question not of recognition, it's a question of measurement. We can discuss it. So to finish, the two conclusions I began. First one, I think we are speaking about a narrow scope now. I think we have to broaden the scope. And also, please bear in mind that from my point of view, if finally this proposal from the ASB is approved, from my point of view, it's honest, it's only my point of view, I think that very similar activities will have different asset recognition criteria. So thank you, and I'm open to questions.
I do have quite a few comments, but I think Pascal, you go ahead first, and I'll kick in at the end.
Thanks, Jean. I want to say that I fully agree with Jesus. I even have some real life example in the water division. There's environment which was a state operate some water business in the US under regulation with regulated asset and liabilities according to US GAAP. And in France we operate some water business under Aspect 12. And we have the same questions about matching, or I don't know, timing difference, or matching cost of revenue. Because regulator set up tariff based on cost and a kind of fair return for the company. The point is that aspect 12 is different because we have to give back the asset at the end of the concession. So maybe the tariff is built differently, and I think I would have Mary. I think that if you remember, it was discussed at aspect 12 time discussion about how to book about renewal of the asset of the infrastructure, which is has to be given back for zero to the grantor. So usually in such business, we have to book a liability or an accrual because you have a timing difference about cost and revenues, and so as it was explained by Richard, you have a profit and loss which is meaning less because you may have a very big profit at the beginning of the concession and you will have losses at the end of the concession because you have to do some renewal work. So it's really key for concessions, and it's key for the regulatory business. But the point is that the mechanism is different because you really have to give the asset back at the end of the concession, or if you have a license with a limited time, you have some, you will pay back for you, I would say, investment. But the question is really exactly the same in both mechanisms. That's why I understand the question about narrowing the scope or not, and I put it differently. Be careful about IFRIC 12 and even this will be short IFRIC 4 because we have the same mechanism for public-private initiatives. And so we apply, I would say today, IS 18, revenue recognition, IS 2, and so on. I know that cost accounting guidance in IFRS is very niche, but we have a few paragraphs we use to have this, to recognize matching of cost and revenues, and to have a fair presentation of the performance of this, I would say, public service or companies involved in public service, because I agree that it's limited. This kind of mechanism are limited to companies operating in public service.
Yeah, my found the presentation very useful and thought provoking. We go through these steps to look at these. I think over a 10-year period, the end result is the same. You're going to make 10 profit. However, I don't think the examples themselves are the same within interim periods throughout that 10 years, because apart from anything else, the cost profile and revenue profile is very different. Mm-hmm. So I would not, absent other features, the breakdown of costs between capital and expenses, I wouldn't expect similar accounting treatments within those interim periods. So I came to the completely different conclusion to you from reading this presentation, that this presentation demonstrated the need for different accounting rather than the need for the same accounting. But I've come in from reading it, whereas you come in from preparing it. Over the 10 years, it's the same result, but the profile of revenue and cost is very different than the interim periods.
You can see that the profile in the sample line is, you had a lot of scope initial years, and the question now is that in example A, you are proposing, I think that is proposing to recognize a regulatory asset, but in example B, no. And it's a discussion for the PML will be different in the two cases. I agree with you, but why are you recognizing a regulatory asset in example A, and why not in example B? That's my question. I'm not asking for the same accounting, the same profit for the projects, because the profile of revenue and expenses is different, and also probably the risk profile is different. And probably the second one has higher risk profile, but it's a discussion of measurement. So, but my question is not, it's a question, why do you recognize a regulatory asset in case A, and why do you do not recognize in case B?
Okay, well that was the follow-on scribble notes I made when reading it, was that, you know, absence of the features I just talked about, those different profiles, if I was being simplistic, I think example A is related to past costs only, where the true-up mechanism, you know, building on your example, guarantees that they're going to be recovered. If they don't recover from over the regulatory period, I would assume the true-up mechanism will allow for the example B, you incurred the costs and you're incurring future costs that are past costs and future costs, and there is an anticipation that you will recover the costs, but not a guarantee.
So
Pascal is shaking us through it. Completely wrong, but that's how I read the example.
In the case A, you don't have a complete guarantee, because also you have open to demand risk. I don't know, probably we had to discuss what happens if finally the electricity consumption in that 10 years is lower than expected. Then we had another to-back mechanism, another automatic adjustment for the next 10 years, or the automatic adjustment. So the discussion is finally, you are asking, 100% guarantee that you are receiving the money. You have a financial asset. You don't have to discuss here about regulatory assets, because you have the solution, you have a financial asset, you have the right to receive cash. That's a discussion that was open when we were discussing IFRIC 12. You remember IFRIC 12, you had two models. You had the intangible asset model and the financial asset model. And the financial model is the case where you have 100% guarantee, because the government is paying to you. And they say, no problem with demand rate. I will pay you this money during the concession period. In that case, we don't have to discuss about regulated assets. We have to analyze is this asset a financial asset according with current standards, IFRS 9? Yes, no? Well, we can discuss. But here we are discussing about regulated assets. So, from my point of view, demand risk and risk is a question, but it's a question, let me repeat, of measurement, not of recognition.
Yeah, I suppose I could maybe take a step back and come at it from a slightly different perspective, which is, you know, what is the regulation actually achieving? And I think that this maybe comes to the heart of why I see them as actually being different. You know, in the example around the road, it is about achieving that return over an extended period. I think quite often what you find with rate regulation or incentive-based regulation, so it becomes a revenue recognition question, which is that what the regulation does is, in effect, set the revenue that's allowed for each interim period of activity. And if you have a direct link between how the regulation actually works and what you're allowed to earn for each interim period, not over a 10-year period, but actually, you know, on an annual basis. And certainly if you look at incentive-based regulation, the true mechanism does is basically say, this is the revenue you're allowed to earn for that 12-month period, this is the revenue you're allowed to earn for that 12-month period. So for me, this is less about thinking about assets and liabilities and actually about making sure that revenue is in the right period and that revenue reflects the activity and what you're allowed to earn in that period. And that's what these mechanisms do. And that's why I do see them as different. I think you're right, over the entire period, you might well end up with the same economic answer. But what regulation does in the case of rate regulation or incentive-based regulation is actually look at economic performance in each 12-month period over that period. And I think that is where there is a difference. There is a difference in actually looking at revenue recognition as opposed to your asset liability recognition.
May I?
I just wanted to ask you, could I just clarify my understanding of one aspect of the facts of your two examples, which is in example A, you've shown costs of 100 in year zero and 20 in year one, and I assume those are the hurricane costs that you referred to, and then there are no other costs shown here, but I assume that company A would have fuel costs, other, you know, other operating costs, salary costs, etc.
Probably, yes, I think.
Depreciation.
I'd like to say these are the costs related with the impact of hurricane. Probably they will have also costs during the next year. But this is only an example.
That's what I thought, but I just want to check that. And then in example B, the 120 of costs that you have, in example B, they're spread out, not evenly, but they're spread out over the 10 years rather than being just year 0 and 1. Are those, what kind of costs were you thinking of? I mean, obviously, this is a very simplified example, but...
Yes, I think the main... You have the financial expenses.
Okay.
And financial expenses are very high at the beginning of the operation of the concession. This is a question. And you have depreciation. And you have operating expenses.
And all the money you are spending in the project. But the main component is financial expenses and depreciation. And also taxes.
And let me say, in the scale of the Spanish GAAP, we have now this type of regulatory asset for financial expenses. Thinking on these key features I have been trying to mention. And also, it's important the right to economic finance balance, because this is the right that you say, if you are going to have big problems, probably you are going to receive a compensation from the government. And now we had a problem in Spain, because according to Spanish GAAP, for the individual statutory account, we are recognizing that asset.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of financial consolidated financial statements under IFRS for listed companies, as my company is, we are not recognizing that regulated asset. And finally, that regulated asset is recognized only for tax purposes, because normally the individual statutory accounts are used for tax purposes.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a question that has been discussed in the past, and I think it's the key issue, you know, the discussion on financial expenses probably is the higher component in a concession in the initial year.
Yeah. I thought that's what it was, and it was just, I think one thing I want to think about when comparing example A to example B is whether it's a like-to-like example, if in example B it includes financial and operating expenses. In example A, it's looking at only the unusual costs, the hurricane costs, because my understanding...
Yeah, probably, I think there's a mistake in example A, because it should be included also financial expenses during the next year.
Yeah.
Because normally, you are incurring an investment, you're spending money, you are incurring the money in the future, you have financial expenses.
Right.
But in any case, you can have financial expenses in one case and in another case. Yeah. In the first one, in the case of the hurricane, you have a regulatory, deferral account with all that expenses in a separate part of the financial statement of the company. In this case, all the companies are regulatory deferral accounts, because digamos, the company is a special purpose company that is prepared or has been incorporated only for the operation of the concession.
I just wanted to check that I was reading the example right and understanding the difference in the nature of the expenses between the two examples.
Okay.
My question is similar to Mary's, but I think slightly different, in that I looked at these two examples as being different because the electricity example was an incremental, unexpected cost that was being reimbursed, and it seemed to me that the better analogy to the toll road would have been the initial costs of the electricity transport company for the physical plant that they will be recovering over the period of the physical plant. And that, to me, would have been more analogous to the toll road rather than the incremental, unexpected cost.
Yes, I see your point. I probably agree with you, but the question why I had to use these two examples, because one of my concerns, the first one, is that I don't understand why we are proposing a different treatment if we are speaking about initial investment and deviation. So in the example, I have said, I use a deviation that we include in the scope, and in example B, I have included the initial investment, but probably it would be more useful to use two examples of the electricity company, the first one with the deviation and the second one with initial. So the reason of using that different, in one case deviation and in another case initial investment, is to, in order to illustrate my concern about different treatment for deviation and to initial investment.
I mean, when I was looking at these two example cases, I was, again, because we were comparing like with like, I see this project as trying to identify what it is about rate regulation that is different from other activities that we've already got IFRS guidance or requirements for. And the concern I had with example B is that I think a lot of what's contained in example B is already covered by IFRIC 12, IS 18 on revenue recognition, IS2 on inventories, because it does combine the ongoing costs as well as the initial setup costs of the project. What I see as trying to do within the rate regulation project is to say, well, those normal ongoing costs, which may include some tiny differences, because you may have high initial startup costs with low initial startup revenues, but you agree to take on the contract because you're confident that the revenues will increase in the future to get back those initial and heavy startup costs. But we already have accounting standards that deal with that. What I don't think we've got an accounting standard for is these unusual costs that are not part and parcel of a contract that's ongoing and that's been built in initially. It's something that is occurring because of something that's happened in the past, and we then have different mechanisms to allow us to recover those costs or earn those revenues, and I try and add on the or earn those revenues, because I don't think we're talking just about costs that have been incurred and we're looking to defer them to try and get a better matching with revenues that we're confident we're going to earn in the future. We're trying to identify what rights and obligations are established by the rate regulation. And as Michael pointed out, it's a combination of setting up rights and obligations, which are connected to trying to identify what revenue is allowable within a particular period. Sometimes we don't earn the revenue that's allowable, but the right that we've got is that we can catch up. Sometimes we earn too much revenue, and we've got an obligation then to reverse that out and give that revenue back in the future. So that's why I see examples A and B as being very different examples, and why I, at the moment, am feeling reasonably comfortable that we get different patterns of revenue and cost recognition going through those.
My question here is, if I think in the example of the toll road, for me it's difficult to understand, and I agree with you that now concessions is considering effect 12, and also you can discuss, apply other standards, and now you are trying to regulate the robotics activities. But coming back to the example of the toll road, for me it's difficult to understand why, if I had an initial investment, I don't have to analyze, I apply regulated activities. But if I have that deviation, then we have to analyze if this newer standard is applicable. For me, it's difficult to understand because at the end of the day, it's the same. It's a question of have an investment and it's a monopoly that is regulated. The prices, you are not free to fix the prices because the government is trying to protect consumers from your dominant position. And it's the same. It's initial investment, deviation. And probably if there is a deviation, suppose I begin to run this into road, and at the end of the day I had a deviation because the government has asked me to build a new lane, additional lane, different than the initial project. There is a deviation, and they say, no, and for that new lane, I will fix new tariffs. And then another day, I had to apply the regulated standard for this new lane. The two first lane, no. But the third lane, the new lane, yes, because it's a deviation. So for me, from an economic point of view, it's difficult to understand. Why do you apply these only two deviations, not two initial investments? So that's my point.
I think, isn't that two different things? The deviation there is an agreed deviation that you're doing an additional lane to the road, and therefore again you would look at what the contractual rights and obligations are attaching to that and work out what costs should be capitalised because it's part of the investment cost, what costs the additional operating costs. But that's an event that you account for as and when it happens, because you haven't yet been asked to do that deviation, whereas what we're talking about with true-up adjustments is something that has happened already. We're not just trying to anticipate the future.
I agree with completely. I think that the issue of the substance of the regulation, it doesn't matter so much if we in advance initially plan to receive the cost during the period. We have an example. I think that the example could be slightly better, but I don't think that this is the main thing. We have a gas company that is a state-owned company, and we considered using the EPCC well, but it's one of the terms in EPCC that it's a contract between a private and the government parties. So we couldn't use this one for this for measuring the cost and the system levy. So, but this is also a very technical difference. I think that the main thing is the substance of the rate regulation. If we have a rate regulator, it doesn't matter so much if the cost already accrued or planned that it will be accrued during the year. But we have the assurance that the cost will be returned. Also, I think that the conceptual framework doesn't help us so much, because the the subject of the measurements and recognition has to be very, we have to deal with this very much because it's very complicated. And I don't think that helps us in this matter. But I think that also when I read the conceptual framework, I saw that it allows certain standards to be not exactly with the conceptual framework. We have this special thing that allows us to think openly about the. About the substance of the race regulation and its very unique terms, and not to be part of the conceptual framework. So I would leave this, the conceptual framework aside from now. So.
If I may just, because I think you read the question to be consistent with other standards with industries who are not in the regulation or not in IC12. I've been working a long time for other industries, so when I started to work on concessions, it was 10 years ago, I thought with my I was very shy with IS 11 and IS 18, and so for me, in a concession, you have a contract. We at the end of the contract, so if I may answer to Bill, you know the tariff for the coming, you have a tariff for the length of the concession. So you, and you know as when you, for example, you build a ship or a factory, a turnkey factory, so you know what you're going to sell and what the costs are going to be. Okay? The point is that what is different is that you have to provide your client. You cost the industry, you don't know. You do not do that. You do not provide the cost base to your client because you're in a competitive market. So in such businesses, it's not a competitive market. So you have to provide your cost accounting to the client, I would say, to the grantor. So that's part of concession and regulation. And that's different. What is different? But you have your tariff and you have your cost. The point, you have two different questions. You have what is included in the tariff and what is not included in the tariff. And in some regulation, if you have a hurricane, I understand, or some cost, you know that the regulator will grant you, I would say it's a tariff deviation, or you have the right to build this extra cost, I would say. But you have also mechanisms which are two mechanisms because of authorized revenue, and the mechanism could be different because for risk regulation in France, for example, for the grid business, for the gas business, transport, the grid, you have a 4-year tariff. So, and you know that you know your revenue for 4 years with no risk. So no questions. I think we're not talking in this example. We're not talking of what is not expected. So I was asked, it's a real life example again. I was asked last week by the grid business because they have to change some pipes and they don't know because they have to change from gas. To get each because we have to change the supply and so on. So, and they don't know if it will be included in the tariff or not. And I said, if it's not included in the tariff, I would say it's an operating expense, and there is no, I would say, no way for me to have an asset or liability. And even because you have contract, you have a contract, but there is no end, so you don't have any margin. And it's impossible to calculate whether it's an onerous contract or not. And it's not an onerous contract because usually I think it doesn't work if regulated business is onerous. I think no more investors will go in that business, so that's another story. So I think really what is different is that the client has the right to audit
and that the cost are included in the tariff. So in the example B, even if I don't know, I were in Spain, I think in the water business, for example, even I were in France, we have the same mechanism. So if it's a new asset, we are going to discuss with the client. If it's a new or it's included in the tariff. But again, I think it's very difficult to have a rule on that. We have to understand how the tariff is built, what is included in the tariff, and so what we are entitled to bill to the client and to claim and to claim to the grantor. Because, for example, in IFRIC 12 concessions, I had some benefits that I'm tasked with my auditors, so I had a very difficult discussion with my auditors about what happens if at the middle of the concession, grantor say we want to change, we want to have another company operating the water business in Paris, for example. So, and we had some legal opinion, and now it's included in the contract that we have the right to the cash and buy this in cash, what was invested by the company. We have a right, even if it's not regulated assets and liabilities, it's contractual or it's legal. So that's why I agree with Ressouche. If we have a too tiny or too narrow scope, maybe it will have consequences on other businesses where we have to apply broad principles about what is the contract, what is billed to the client, what is our legal right to get the cash back from a grant or from the client.
I think it's important, if you look at these two examples, because I think we have got the first example, you know, deviation, and secondly, you're looking at normal operating costs, to put them on an equal footing. So let's look at example B, where you have deviations in operating costs, and where you have exceptional events on both sides. So if you look at example A, we have a exceptional cost, a storm cost, where regulation either automatically gives you the right to build cost of that into your tax, or at least give you a right to go to your regulator and say I've incurred this cost. Regulation says effectively it's out of my control, I prudently incurred it, can I please build it into my tariff for next year and the following year, the regulator can say yes or no. And you have that right to go and ask for it, and you have a basis in law or regulation to do that. At the same time, if you have a deviation in your operating costs because you've been inefficient, tough. That doesn't give you the right to do anything other than bear the cost of the inefficiency. It doesn't give you the right to go back and ask for more, unless it is a permanent difference because there's been a significant change, for example, environmental standards that required that cost to increase on an ongoing basis, in which case you may well have the right to go and ask for an increase in your tariff to allow recovery of that cost. In example B, I think what you're saying is that, you know, the operating costs are what they are, and I think, and therefore there is no mechanism to necessarily go and ask for more. The question I would have is, let's say you had some extreme weather and it damaged the road surface and you had to incur, you know, a one-off exceptional cost to do some additional work. What happens? Do you have any right legally to go and ask to increase your tariff? Because I think that, you know, kind of standing back and looking at what rights and obligations does the regulation give you to intervene and reflect on what you see as being something else you should be allowed to recover. I think then you can compare normal costs and deviations, and that maybe gives you an opportunity to see why these are different. And if in the second case you've got a right to go back and ask for more money because of extreme weather, then you maybe it is similar. At the moment, to me, they appear different.
I'd agree. Sorry, can we just bring Karen in? Basically, sticking our hand up and might be getting cramped any minute.
Thank you. I'm starting to fall asleep, my arm. I wanted just to make a point. Can you hear me all right?
Yep.
Thank you. That from a rate regulation perspective, no asset can be constructed without the regulator's approval. And so I support the definition as being proposed and the broadening of it. And I'm comfortable with the focus from a regulatory perspective on this notion of deviations. So when an asset is going to be constructed to meet the service requirements of a customer, regulatory approval has got to be sought and obtained. And the regulator, when that asset is constructed and going to be put into rate base, at that juncture, the regulator will determine how much of those costs should go into rates at that time and what the recovery profile will be. And it will, the judgment of the regulator will be tempered by a number of factors, including the increase in rates for different customer classes. So in some respects, the cash profile that Jesus has presented in his concession example can happen in a rate-regulated situation when an asset is introduced to rate base for the first time. So I'm very uncomfortable with the notion that rate regulation only creates variances on a going concern basis through time, because we're forgetting about the very critical example in a rate-regulated setting where a new asset is added to the rate base and it has a material effect on rates, and then it's fully within the scope of the regulator, most jurisdictions that I've studied, to affect the timing and the nature of the cash flow. And that does create regulatory assets and liabilities to the extent that 100% of the operating costs and capital costs as amortized are not covered in the initial tariff or rate that's charged and authorized. So I like the definition. I don't understand enough about IFIC 12 and the other standards to understand why that concession would not be recognized as creating a right to recover certain things. If you go back to the accounting definition of at least that's being proposed, of assets and liabilities, it seems to me that the distinction is one that would be lost if the new definitions are adopted.
Thanks, Karen. And PK, you've been waiting for ages, and then Bill.
Very kind of you. Two things. I just want to make a comment that I think, first of all, thanks to Jesus for taking this effort to put it together. Very kind of you. I think much discussion has happened on the example A and example B. I think I have sympathy for his argument, and I think if we discard example B in the proposed rate-regulated discussion paper or anything, we need to give a very solid reason for that, because I feel, and there is enough people feel, you know, let's try to understand that. I think that I don't want to delve too much on it, but I want to go to the definition for a second, and I have two questions here, and see if you have any thoughts on it. First question is that, suppose there are three players in a market who can provide electricity to me. Like, you know, I get a phone call saying that we can switch from one to the other. Mm-hmm. One person who owns 60% of the market, another person owns 30% of the market, and the third person owns 10% of the market. How does he fit into the dominant position situation here, the 10% person? You follow me? There are three people who can provide electricity, and the third person has only 10% of the market share today. Why would he not be affected by the rate regulator? Because he's not in dominant position to the other two. I don't think you want to exclude them. I don't think you mean to exclude them. But I think I'm not doing wordsmithing here, but I just want to push back a little bit and say.
I don't know. I am not doing a specialist. So they might be probably here around the table. There is a lot of people working for electricity companies. But I understand from my point of view, I was thinking when you are in an aluminium position, is you are only the only player. For example, if you are selling transport toll roads between, say, between Washington and New York, at this only toll road, you are the owner. You have 100% of the market, because. If you say, no, you are competing with the trend, I don't know.
Yeah, I
understand in terms of electricity network and electricity transport, there is a problem of a physical competition, and this is a question of there is related activity. I know there are people here working for this.
In a different way, I don't think, in my way, I would interpret that any of those companies would fall under this proposal, because 50% is not a monopoly or dominant. So even the company with the largest percentage, I think there's competition if you have three providers,
so what,
as opposed to an environment where...
But everything else it happens, the regulator is supported by legislation, there's a price variance, they can recover it, so I don't know whether we intend to exclude them, because when I read that,
it's interesting that you exclude even the 60%, but I thought I would exclude only 10 and maybe 30%, and that would be unfair. But something we need to think about when if we go down that route.
That I think is about understanding nature of the market. So in delivering that power to you, there will be an element of the cost of that, which is the transportation of that power or gas, which will be a monopoly. The elements which relate to supplying the power to you is competitive, and because it's competitive, there may be regulation around how you treat your customers fairly. There may be regulation around a price cap so that it protects vulnerable customers. But it's unlikely that you would land up in regulation in the sense that we are talking about, where you can go and ask for variances from cost or revenue, because it is a competitive market.
But the transport company in that thing, yep. that person who delivers electricity to my house,
yes.
Can he charge anything he wants to charge? No, I know he cannot charge. So he can charge anything lower, but he cannot charge it.
So the customers of the transport company are those companies that are selling you the power. So as a transport company, unlikely that you would be my customer. As a transport company, it would be, and it may be in the same group, but a different party activity, but my customer would be whoever is supplying that power to you. And my activity would be regulated. Here, what I would be looking at is how you account for that activity, separately from how you account for the activity of supply. The issue here is there are differences, nuances between different markets, but fundamentally that's where I think you would land up.
I just wanted to, as somebody trying to learn this area, I just wanted to say, are we openly, consciously excluding them? Is that right? It's something we need to think about. I'm not saying that we are married to this definition, but I'm just trying to pick that aspect to say, is that what you are leaning to?
Yeah.
Can I just complete the second question here and see?
Oh.
I don't see anywhere here this is compensating for the variable incentive portion of it. I know you put it in the big box here that it also covers the incentive, but I don't see any aspect here that covers the incentive portion of it. And also, again, you helped me with my old age, did we kind of, was there any kind of, not a tentative, but some kind of inclination that we will only cover cost, or we thought last time it was both? How did that end up?
Again,
we are not going to foreclose ourselves to any one direction, but I just wanted to get what was our thought there last time,
yeah.
The combined group.
Where we get into this, and the conversation has drifted into the other features that are in this paper, which we haven't touched on yet, so I'm glad it's drifted there, but I think we're confusing two different conversations. But so to your first point, PK, we haven't made any decisions yet on excluding, because one of the purposes of this session this morning was to look at these features and decide whether we think we need to keep them in, whether we need to kick them out, whether we need to shift priorities. So do we need to have a dominant position or a monopoly position is a question for us to discuss as the morning goes on. With regards to where we got to so far in our discussions, we are looking at the true-up adjustment not just to cover past costs, so things like the hurricane costs or whatever, but the possibility of the incentive, but a particular type of incentive, which is there are some types of regulation we've seen where there is an incentive target, and the regulation is written as such that if you achieve that particular target or multiple targets, you do have the right to then have an upgrade to the tariff, so you can effectively earn a bonus. And I'm thinking it was Dwayne, it was you that I think gave this example in the meeting in July, where there is the possibility that the regulators say you need to hit something like a customer service target. The regulator then will kind of estimate an amount that they think is a reasonable bonus or reward for meeting that target. And then based on the estimate of what the volume is likely to be, we'll set the tariff accordingly. So the way that we've been moving in the ISV discussion is that we're looking at what are the rights to the revenue rather than necessarily what created that right. So it could be a cost or it could be a performance or whatever. And I'm conscious Michael
Do you want to come back to the previous conversation and then we'll move on to the other pieces?
Thank you. Looking at the examples that you provided and picking up on a comment I think Patricia had made about looking at the, you know, would it have been useful to compare in example A with the construction of the power station? And the reason I'm just sort of bringing this up is that I wonder whether there's an element here of, with the toll road, there is the construction of these additional lanes plus the operating of them afterwards. So in your costs that you show in the profile here, does that reflect an element of the construction of the asset in the first place and then the tapering off of costs, but the revenues themselves sort of then increase over time but at a delayed start to it. And I just wonder whether there's an element here which has to do with sort of the cost profile and the revenue profile being distinctly different here in a manner which perhaps with the normal construction of a power station wouldn't be either there wouldn't be a different profile or the profiles would be very much more similar to one another, and so therefore your example and example B is more pronounced in terms of the differences here. And sort of join that up with some of the costs that we've been talking about. A lot of the costs we've been talking about, I think, with the scope of this so far have been ones which would ordinarily be recognised in profit or loss in the period. They're like operating costs, effectively. And so then they're incurred, they're then sort of given an additional piece of a right to charge additional revenue in the future, and so we're picking them up on that basis. I wondered whether this is an additional aspect, again, still linked with rate regulation, but connected perhaps more with the construction of a capital asset, which the regulator then says you can earn the revenue for this, but it's going to be over a different pattern of revenue recognition than the normal cost recognition would be for operating the asset.
Can I just jump, because I've got my question was directly related to it, except to slightly the other side of the coin. I was listening to the discussion, I was reading these examples of saying, in example A, we have deviations from cost, and we think we're going to be able to recognise the asset. In example B, and I was saying that none of these costs are capital, and I say, these in years one or two, we have what I call pre-launch operating costs, which you're required to expense under all the guidance, but you're going to get a return on. So it's why have we got a difference? But because these are deviations, I can put them on the balance sheet, but because they're pre-launch, I can't put them on the balance sheet, but in the end, I'm going to get a return for both of them. And I would extend my course to say that we might be able to differentiate those two examples, because they're very different, but we're going to get closer. They're going to be real-life examples, which are really on the boundary of the difference. So I think we have the same question, but approaching it, you're approaching it from the capital side, I'm approaching it from the operating expense.
And I was just concerned about whether there is a second strand of rate regulated accounting here that we need to be thinking about that has some different characteristics from the one we've been focusing on so far. Maybe there isn't, but I just wanted to raise that as a possibility.
Okay.
Thank you. Gwen.
Following up on your question, one of the points of clarification I was hoping to get today from the scoping framework that you've laid out, are we talking about the financial reporting entity, or are we talking about activities within the financial reporting entity? And it kind of gets to the question of the transmission, the transport versus the supply of energy. So in my company, we're vertically integrated in different components, though, and part of it is unregulated, part of it is regulated. And it was unclear to me if the way I was reading it was to a say, am I in scope or not in scope of this particular standard? Are we looking at all your activities have to be meeting these definitions, or is it a certain activity that you would apply whatever the standard ends up asking us to apply for that portion of the business? And I just, that may get to some of the things you were wondering about, because I was talking just about the commodity or the purchase of the energy when I said I wouldn't include any of them, but certainly Michael's point is the transport would probably be regulated in the way we're thinking in the standard.
I mean, I think my impressions so far, but please do, if anybody's got any different impressions, bring them forward. My impressions would be that we need to look at this on the activity level, not the entity level, mainly because so many companies have got different activities along the stream. I know in some countries the transport has to be done by a different company than the distribution, different companies for the generation, but in many jurisdictions it can be the same entity that does each phase in the supply. So I think it does need to be at the activity level, and the type of regulation and the features of regulation are different at those different levels. So I can't see from a practical point of view how we can do it at an entity level.
Okay, sorry. Now, to answer to the question from Michael and from Bill, no? Here in the cost, I agree in example D, I agree in the depreciation that is related with initial investment there. But you are recognizing that that as a cost during the life of the concession, as a depreciation component. But when you are discussing, if we are discussing about operating or investment or OPEX or CAPEX, from an economic point of view, I see it's similar to examples, because you are spending money to probably to build new towers of electricity because some of that has been destroyed by the hurricane. In other case, you are building a new road or you are rebuilding or refurbishing the surface of the road. I don't know. So at the end of the day, it's a mix of CAPEX and OPEX. But one question is the accounting, and the question is from an economic point of view. It's similar. You're speaking of a mix of CAPEX that is recovered, that you recognize as a cost through the depreciation, and OPEX maintenance cost, and also a very important a key element that is the financial expenses.
Yeah, and that's why I'm coming back to, I think the examples, and we went into the detail very quickly, illustrate the difference between deviations and initial. And the question is, a standard is being anticipated to deal with deviations. And the question we have to ask is, are we satisfied with keeping the scope to deviations when, arguably, initial costs, which would normally be expense, are in substance very, very similar, because you're going to get them back. So here I have a standard, it applies to deviations only. Job done. But initial costs in substance are very similar because I'm going to get them back, but I have to expense them. And we then have to ask the question, are we satisfied with having only a narrow scope standard? Or should we look at having a wider scope standard, maybe to go back to a narrow scope standard? Or do we say that, look, initial costs are such a wider issue, and I come back from a pharmaceutical background where some companies expense pre-launch stock, some companies, or eventually some companies capitalize it. So those initial costs, I think are a far wider issue and analogous to lots and lots and lots of industries. But we probably do need to consider, this is why I think it's so important, that if we're going to write this standard, or the ISP is going to write it, are we satisfied with that narrow scope? And if so, demonstrate why we're not dealing with, in substance, similar circumstances, I think, in a wider one.
Maybe we got to talk a little bit. Got to see that clear.
Yeah. I mean, does anybody have any views? Sorry, Michael.
Yeah, I'm just been reading through the definition on page 1000 on slide 8 in terms of India.
Can you increase the volume, please?
Sorry, I've just been reading the definition on slide 8 that he's just set out, and I think, you know, as I walk through it, I think until I get to the very last bullet point, I'm very comfortable with it. And I think the reason I'm sort of less comfortable with the last bullet point is I think it's quite restrictive in terms of what it then allows the scope to be, because I think it focuses on cost recovery. And for me, actually, the combatants is not about cost recovery, it's about revenue recognition. And, you know, for me, the last bullet point is actually what the regulation does, is it allows the regulator to regulate revenue on the basis of an accounting period. Because I think, for me, that's what triggers, you know, because we ask this question every time we get to balance sheet date, because the question is, should we, have we recognised the appropriate revenue for the period, and therefore, should we have assets or liabilities in our balance sheet that represents amounts which we can either collect in the future, or we have to have some mechanism for returning to the consumer. And for me, to move away from discussion around cost recovery to one of revenue recognition, I think is probably the most important thing.
Can I just ask you, I've referred a few times to focus on the accounting period. But presumably if there were these past costs, these deviations from costs that have been incurred, they could be covered over, recovered over three periods rather than one period, you wouldn't stop just at the one period, would you?
No, but what you're doing is looking at what, it depends what kind of example you're thinking of, Michael. So, you know, so if I incur a cost in this period, what regulation may allow you to do is to recover that cost and actually recover that over, you know, an extended period. But actually the asset that you hang up in balance sheet in that scenario is the full amount that you're allowed to recover, i.e. it is revenue recognition in this accounting period. If you look at incentive-based regulation, fundamentally incentive-based regulation says is you've got a 5-year price control period. This is the revenue you're going to be allowed to reach in those 5 years. That's your allowable revenue. Now that's based on underlying operating costs and so on, but there's that revenue is set. If in year one, because of some variation in volume, you don't collect all that allowable revenue, you're allowed to collect in future periods. But the revenue still relates to that period because that was your allowable revenue for that period.
Even if the cost that was incurred in year zero was recovered over years 1 to 3 on
that sort of
year.
That's what I mean. I don't think it's about cost recovery, I think it's about revenue. So that different types of regulation do different things. Okay, so some are cost recovery based and some are incentive based. In incentive based regulation, you are not recovering costs. What effectively is happening is you are your revenue is set, and effectively it's up to you to be as efficient or inefficient as you can be, and you take or lose it on the bottom line because of that. But in a sense, so to kind of maybe compare and contrast incentive-based regulation, I go into price control, the regulator would say, and this is being very simplistic, it's a little bit more complicated, but the regulator would say to me, okay, over those 5 years, your revenue, your allowable revenue that you're allowed to recover from customers, no more than this, but you're allowed to recover this amount, is 105 in year 1, 110 in year 2, 115 in year 3, 120 in year 4, 125 in year 5. That is your allowable revenue. So what the company will do is say, well, okay, I need to work out how I collect that. This is how much I think I'm going to transport. So volume, revenue divided by volume, that gives me my price. So you bill your customers. At the end of the year, let's say it's been warmer than you expected, so you haven't transported as much as you expected to do. So instead of collecting 105, you've only collected 100. You still have the right to go and collect that 5 in respect of this year. All you simply do is say, well, when I'm calculating my price for next year, I've got my starting point of my allowable revenue for next year, 110. I'm allowed to collect another 5 on top of that, which relates to this year, because my estimate didn't work out quite correctly. So it goes on. And usually, from a regulatory reporting point of view, you're actually required to report to the regulator each year outside your financial accounting, effectively demonstrating exactly how that works. So here's what I was allowed to get, here's what I estimated my volumes were, here's what the actual was, here's what I collected, here's what the difference is, that rolls into next year, here's how I'm going to set my prices. So the regulator can see exactly what you're doing to make sure you're not collecting more than your allowable revenue in respect of any one year. So you both have a right to collect up to that amount and an obligation to collect no more than that amount. So that's how incentive-based is. What's happening to your cost base doesn't matter. When you get to the end of that price control period, you're going to have another negotiation with the regulator, part of which will be around this is what it's cost me to deliver the service.
But once that negotiation is finished, if your revenue is fixed for the next 5 years, costs are relevant.
Could I ask a follow-up question on that example? So, you know, 5 years, can't remember whether you started with 100 or 105, but get up to 125.
Yeah.
Let's say the agreement for that revenue was in part because of costs that you were either budgeted or actually incurred in year zero or year one. Do you see any change in the accounting for the cost because of the revenue promise that you have in that incentive-based system?
No.
Okay. So the accounting for the cost is fixed asset if it's fixed asset, expense if it's expense, no, in essence, acceleration of the revenue that you expect to charge in year three. Okay.
No, so cost is cost and revenue becomes revenue because there's no coupling of the two in that on the regulation. As I said, that was a very simplistic example because it's not just about price regulation. You will usually also be asked to deliver certain investments into the network, certain levels of customer service. So you can have, coming back to that, you can have penalties and incentives over and above that core amount relating to those. And indeed, if you fail to build out parts of your network as you have promised to do, then equally that can affect how you then your allowable revenue over the following 5 year period. So there's a link between cost and revenue in the negotiation you go through with the regulator. But once that negotiation is complete, there is no, without price token, there's no connection whatsoever.
Michael, another follow-up. If that utility had the hurricane expenses
mm-hmm.
in year zero,
mm-hmm.
and that was built into the 100, 105, it's the same question, but you're suggesting that there would not be a reg asset at day one?
Correct.
For the hurricane cost?
Correct. Because revenue is revenue and cost is cost.
Yeah, I'm going to come in here. Karen's got a hand up, and Mary's still got a hand up, and then you've got another follow-up question. But this is sort of touching on something that I do want to talk about, and that's trying to get away from this concept of it's a cost-based regulation or an incentive-based regulation, because from my research, I don't think there's any such thing as pure cost-based or pure incentive-based, and all of the examples that I see have a combination, and I'd like to make a few comments on how that combination kind of works. But Karen, you go ahead first, and I'll come back later.
I'm very happy you said what you did, because I agree with it. There are so many different types of regulations. So the last question about whether the hurricane costs would be recoverable, we have many jurisdictions where, notwithstanding the fact you're an incentive regime, as Michael has described, if you have uncontrollable events, such as a hurricane, you have an off-ramp to the incentive arrangement, and you are, in fact, allowed to put those costs into a deferral account and then apply to the regulator to have them disposed of in future periods. So I think we really need to be careful about getting stuck in certain numerical examples that are too narrowly defined and overly prescriptive or making too many assumptions about the nature of regulation. I think it's important to understand that regulation will create rights and obligations, and we need to focus on those as opposed to how that regulation actually works, because there's an infinite variety of regulation, and they all create rights and obligations, and I think that's the important part of this discussion, and they bind customers.
Going back to Jesus's original paper and some of the issues he raised in it, want to comment about a couple of things that I see as things that the board has to consider in developing discussion paper. One is an implicit rather than explicit point in your paper, which is whether a mechanism that can extend a concession, you know, a grant, should be, if we take the approach outlined by the board, whether that extension mechanism is another means of recovery, whether it would be considered a dual rate mechanism. And I think that was implicit in your paper, but not raised explicitly. Is this a qualifying mechanism? And I think something that may relate to that is, should any model that's developed apply if the mechanism, and let me focus now more on the kind of traditional future period rate mechanism, focuses, I'll say, prospectively only. So it says, okay, regardless of what's happened in the past, let's just look forward and see what costs are expected to be, what expenditures are expected to be. You know, maybe it's incentive-based, maybe it's strictly entity-specific, to Jane's point. Is that prospective focus only something that also should be captured? Because I think that interacts with that extension/rate of return and the proposal in the paper from the board discussion about dual adjustment. And I think it really gets to the heart of dual adjustment, because I heard when I look at the four key features on slide 8, I think it would say you should be captured even if you're in a strictly prospective environment with no look back to what differences between, let's say, expected and actual return are. And I think we just have to put that issue on the table so people understand where we're, any preliminary views we have on where we're going, what our logic is, and invite input not only from this group but more broadly.
Just to provide a little bit more in terms of real life examples, we had a very significant storm about 2 years ago, and we incurred just over $7 million worth of expenses to fix the damage that was associated with the storm. Now, in our particular case, what our regulator has done is it's almost impossible to get insurance. And if it is possible to get it, it's very expensive. So we don't insure our lines. We insure substations or other assets, but the lines that we have self-insurance. So what they have done is given us a self-insurance reserve. And that means that each month as we collect our tariff, a piece of that goes towards that reserve to build up the amount that's in there. And typically we're collecting that in advance. We know that we will have damage, there will be storms. What we can't predict is how much it will cost to fix them. What I can tell you is in the time that I've been with the company, we've had a number of these. And I don't know whether the severity is getting to be higher, but certainly the cost is getting to be a lot higher. So what we do is we take the balance that's in that account and we apply that first against the cost of fixing that damage. And then secondly, we make an application to collect the rest of those costs. So we made that application back in 2011 when the storms occurred. We set it up as a receivable, as a regulatory asset, and we collected it in the first quarter of this year. So all of that money that we asked for has been given to us.
In advance.
No, we collected a piece in advance, and we collected the rest after the fact. But by now, we have collected all of the costs associated with fixing the damage.
Do you have a regulatory liability for the portion that you collected in advance?
Yep.
That's just what the United States might
do. So we do set that up as a regulatory liability. Back in the days when we used to provide all of the disclosure that the interim exposure drafter is now asking for, we used to provide all of that information, so we would tell people what the balance was in that reserve, how much we had collected this year. Obviously we couldn't say how long it was going to take to get rid of it because we really didn't know, we couldn't. But we did let people know how much was in the account and how much we had collected this year. And then afterwards we would tell them how much we had used up, if we had used up in any particular year, and the reason why we had used it. The other thing that I wanted to talk about was I thought that we were going to discuss the expansion of the scope this afternoon as opposed to this morning. So I'm delaying and I'm going to put it until now. But in looking at Jesus's example A, that fits very nicely with the way that we account for things when we first spend money on putting an asset in place. So if we're building a new transmission line, and that's the business that we're in. We only build transmission lines. We're not in any of the other pieces of the electricity industry. When we build a line, it looks exactly like A. We spend $100 million or $200 million, whatever it costs to put the line in place. We don't get any revenue associated with that. until it's been energized and it's providing service. So for the first year, or in the case of some of the major projects that we're building right now, it could be the first 2 to 3 years. We're spending lots of money, and we don't get any revenue until they're up and running and providing service.
But in that case, Richard, wouldn't those costs be capitalized because you're building infrastructure assets, so they're not operating costs? You're not recognising them as an expense in P&L.
That's true. They're tangible assets. You can go and touch. You can see the lines going up.
Don't touch.
I'm not wearing a special suit.
If you rubber eyes, gloves and boots on.
You can take one of the whites, not body whites, I guess.
So you can. However, the reason why I raise it, though, is that there are certain costs that we include in there that some people don't think that we should include. So, for example, we calculate AFUDC, allowance for funds used during construction, and we do that in accordance with the instructions given to us by the regulator. And the way that we calculate that is different from the way that you calculate capitalized borrowing costs under IFRS. So that differential we also set up as a receivable because we know that we will collect it. The regulator has told us. And each time that we go before the regulator with a new general tariff application, they tell us for the next period we can continue to collect it. We also included in there some generalized overhead costs, which again IAS 16 says you can't do, but we've built up a case and that case has been accepted and we build those costs into there. And the third thing that we put in there that some people don't like to see is gains and losses on disposal of assets. So if we take assets out of service and we haven't recovered all of the costs associated with those assets through depreciation, then we put that back into another component of depreciation, and we continue to recover that over the life of the asset. So that's the reason why I raise it, because it's not enough to say that it's capital cost. There are these other components that are included there.
Yeah.
And there's no automatic adjustment, right, for those in your... The dual element component... There's no true-out mechanism.
Not for those particular ones. Once you have the approval from the regulator to recover those costs, you recover them as part of your tariff revenue.
Okay, so that is technically perhaps would not apply, is what you're suggesting. Correct.
I'm looking at James to check this, but I think you would, because saying extra lab costs, if you're in that kind of mechanism, if, let's say, your future revenue is insufficient to recover those costs, then you would be getting the differential. But I think the question is probably more like the question I was asking before about what would you get something up, recognize something up front for that difference.
Yeah,
it goes back to what Michael was saying earlier, and that is that we have a legal right to recover those costs. It's specifically written into the legislation that both the regulator and ourselves operate under. So if for some reason they turned around in the future and we went into a general tariff application and we asked for $200 million, for example, in revenue, and they said, no, you can only have 100, and 200 is the right number, we have the ability to go to court and say that they have not been fair with us, they have not granted us recovery of our costs, nor have they granted us a fair return on the assets that we have invested.
I think if I can just come in there, looking at the examples of things that we've got in the true-up adjustments so far, I think it captures some of the items that Richard's just described, but I accept it's not all of them. And I'm glad you raised it, because one of the things we wanted to get out of this morning was, is there something else that ought to be captured by the scope of what we're looking at with what we're at the moment calling a true-up adjustment, for want of a better phrase to describe it in shorthand. I think the description is in paragraph 10 of paper 2, and I think the last element E, which talks about timing differences, may capture the things like the gains or losses on disposals of capital items, which the regulator will often say if you have to dispose of a certain piece of equipment or you have to retire a certain piece of the infrastructure, you've got a gain or a loss on that. For regulatory purposes, you build it into the tariff to make sure that you either get back the loss or you give back the gain. And I would envisage that being captured as a timing difference. So I don't think it changes the nature. If you've got a gain or loss on disposal of some property, plant or equipment, I would still be inclined to say that is a gain or loss that should be reported in P&L accounts. But then separately you'd look at the regulation and say, well, have we got a right or an obligation associated with that gain or loss? And if so, then if we end up recognising assets and liabilities for these items, that would be captured in that point. What I think is not captured would be the funds that you capitalise, which is the cost of equity effectively capitalised, that we may need to add to the list of items that we need to think about capturing within the scope. Again, the general overheads I would capture as a timing difference. So from a financial reporting point of view, they are general overheads and so therefore should be reported as operating costs at the time that they're incurred. But then separately, and this is why it ties back to Michael's comment, it's a matter of revenue recognition and rights and obligations. It's not really about just deferring costs. I've been told several times, and I tell lots of people, a deferred cost is not an asset. An asset is a right or a resource that gives you something in the future. A deferred cost doesn't fit that definition. But we could describe it as, or the amount that we recognise is the cost that has been incurred, but that's not the asset. That's just a way of measuring the asset.
Yeah, I just didn't want us to be making assumptions about what was included and what was excluded, and then find out afterwards that people don't like whatever the finished product is because someone else's assumptions are different from the ones that we thought everybody had agreed to.
Yeah. And that really is the purpose of this group, is to make sure that we are being as complete as we can be with the things that you think ought to be captured or ought to be excluded.
This is Sherm Myers.
Hi, Sherm. Please go ahead.
Thank you. I've been raising my hand, but I guess you haven't seen me. As I read your description of the true-up adjustment, the thing that kept coming back to me was that the true-up adjustment really looks to recover costs. However we describe it, and it gets a little bit more difficult when we talk about incentive regulation, but the idea is that it's a cost recovery. There's an entity that has agreed to provide a product or service, the delivery of electricity through the lines. They agree to incur costs to do that, and the regulator agrees that they can recover those costs and a return over a period of time. And there may be political or other considerations, and it's been mentioned before, where the startup of an operation may be ramped up slowly so the ratepayers don't feel the shock. But ultimately, the idea is I can't get away from it, cost recovery. If the regulator allows an entity to recover the costs, you know, you've got a right to a future cash flow. If the regulator is going to make you refund amounts, those storm costs that were billed but never used, you know, you got really lucky and the storms never came. You've got a liability to the customer that you've got to refund. It's a future cash flow, but it boils down in my mind, and maybe my mind is very simple, but it really boils down to cost recovery, and then how do we extend that to the more difficult incentive regulation, which I think is it could be termed cost recovery also, just a little bit different.
Michael, can you comment there?
Well, I suppose I was looking at paragraph 9 just on paper 2. And there's a couple of things that kind of come to mind. So just reading it, you know, so without rate regulation, most entities can make real-time adjustments to selling prices.
And I think if you think about, you know, and then goes on to say such real-time price adjustments are rarely available to rates regulated entities. So if you think about what I described in terms of incentive-based regulation, a variance in volume does give you the right to change your prices, because it's revenue that's regulated, not price, to collect the revenue that you're allowed to collect, no more, no less than. So reading that, that would be explicitly excluded based on that discussion. And I don't think that's the intention from what I'm hearing. So I'm just a little bit concerned around that. And then I think the second piece is this notion that, I don't think it's explicit, but kind of comes out, which is that these true-ups are automatic, they just kind of happen. And the reality is there's usually a right or an obligation of some kind, but quite often, you know, a regulatory process or a negotiation or something to go through. So it's not as instantaneous as it's necessarily implied here.
Yeah.
And that's the other piece for me that I struggle with a little bit on here, because you can actually land up with a whole basket of these, some which are automatic, some which actually you park and you come back and you talk about a year later, 2 years later, some which are, we think we're going to be able to collect this, but the regulator's not going to tell us for 2 years because it's an incentive. So there are a few things in there that I think almost try and get to too much detail about the mechanism itself, as opposed to actually what's the purpose. And the focus on the purpose, I think, for me is the key thing.
I've got a question in terms of what you tend to cover. In South Africa, for example, they talk about prudent and efficient costs. So when we talk about the automatic adjustment, but what the regulator will do, it will first consider the additional cost that you incur, whether it's prudent and efficient. And my question then is that seen as part of the recognition, or is that seen as part of the measurement?
That's a good question, which we haven't talked about yet. Because one of the things that we're trying to do is kind of break this project down. We started off by, you know, we potentially have got a massive array of different types of rate regulation, and that's why we started focusing on features to try and break it down so we could have a manageable project. And that's why I was slightly nervous with the way this discussion was going this morning, because we're trying to break down the features that we think distinguish rate regulation from other general commercial activities, and trying to match revenue profiles and cost profiles is common to all types of activities and rate regulation, which is why we've been trying to filter down, and we're getting to this true-up adjustment, whatever that might be. It doesn't mean that we don't blow it back out again later on, but it's just a way of making the project more manageable. And I think the point that you just raised, Jakob, is I think it's the next step in the discussion. If we can identify what is the right and obligation that we're looking to try and account for, then we can look in slightly more detail about the mechanism and how automatic it is, because Michael's quite right, they're not always automatic. Sometimes you get what's something called a pass-through adjustment, which is quite often fuel costs in the energy industry, where it says if your fuel costs go up, you get an automatic adjustment that in 2 months' time you can increase the price, and you don't need to negotiate with the regulator because it's a very identifiable cost. You can't avoid it, so therefore they can build that in. There are other types of costs where within the regulation it's built in to say that these types of costs you can recover, but they will be subject to an audit by the regulator to confirm that they were unavoidable or they were uncontrollable type costs. And I think that then becomes, that does become more of a recognition of measurement, because that's based more on probability rather than, I think, existence. You have a right to recover certain types of costs. You then have to decide exactly what amount of those costs the regulator will agree to. But I think it may be easier to look at them separately, but we do definitely have to pull them together at the end.
Thank you.
To accentuate some of the comments Michael made and others. You know, as I look at the agenda, white paper 2, and you go to page, where is it? It's 11 and 12. When I read through all this material, I really got a very different impression than you've described verbally here in terms of things like the construction costs and the return on the construction costs, and that would potentially qualify as being in scope because we make such a distinction on the single adjustment mechanism that unless there's the way I read it, unless there's a dollar for dollar to the penny kind of true up at the end, and that's adjusted for volume differences and, you know, weather was really good and you got more revenue, that then you wouldn't apply that. I'm kind of confused why there was such a distinction between the single element and the dual element if the intention was to have it be a little broader than perhaps that very precise fuel plus dollar for dollar automatic adjustment.
Right. Perhaps that is just the reason I wasn't thinking so much about the construction cost is I see that most of those get captured by normal IFRS accounting anyway, so that's not a distinguishing feature, except as Richard just pointed out, the funds that you apply, the effectiveness, the cost of equity that you have, I don't think is captured, so we do need to pull that out, which I'm grateful for the meeting, that's what we need to try and clarify. I think the distinction we were trying to make between the single element and the dual element is that the single element is the sort of adjustment that I think all businesses try and make to their selling price, in that you set a selling price based on your expected cost base and what you would like your market to be, and you think the market will accept. If your cost base changes, you make decisions as to whether increase or decrease your price accordingly. So if your cost base goes up, you make a decision to say, well, you know, if that cost is going to continue at the higher level, do we need to put our prices up to recover those future higher costs? And what we're trying to distinguish here is between price adjustments that are reflecting future costs at the higher level, and cost adjustments that relate specifically to past events, you know, B-day transactions, storms, changes in cost levels, etc. And perhaps we haven't captured the distinction adequately enough. And that's really what we're trying to distill, is we're looking at the regulation saying you can earn this amount of revenue for this period, based on these estimated circumstances, with quite often some adjustments for unexpected circumstances, as opposed to the sort of regulations that say these are our anticipated amounts, this is the amount that you can earn, but if it's different, then kind of tough. If you get a further period, we'll have a look at adjusting the tariffs in the further period, but those adjustments will be to reflect your ongoing costs rather than looking specifically at the past.
My feedback would be, in practice, I'm not sure that is as clear a distinction as we may be hoping. One of our utilities has what we call a formula rate, which means they go in each year and they estimate what their cost plus return on rate base is going to be, and a recovery of rate base through depreciation. And the next year, and then they apply that rate as an estimate, and then the next year there's a true-up mechanism, but the true-up mechanism does not take into account if volumes were higher or lower, that isn't adjusted. They just look at the rate base and the cost. But then, at the end, there's an ROE collar. As long as your return is within this collar, there's no further adjustment. But if you happen to earn a little bit more, let's say weather was really hot and it pushed you over the ceiling for ROE, then you have to refund some money to customers, or vice versa, if it was really, you know, summer cold. So that is a very hybrid model, I think, in terms of how I'm reading this. And so I just would offer that I'm not sure... I'm not sure if that utility would be in scope or not, so the way this is written right now.
But my initial reaction would be that the amount above or below the collar probably ought to be captured, because there will be a sort of retrospective collection or delivery of that amount. The bit within the collar probably shouldn't be, because you've recorded it in the period that you've earned it. It's all the same, but that's just an initial reaction. It is something that needs to drill down a little bit more on.
I agree with Glenn. I think that the distinctions between the mechanism that makes up in the DBA element and the other mechanism that integrates is not the most important distinction if you would like to separate rate regulated entities from other entities which operate in the competitive market. I think that the true that every company makes tries to anticipate the cost of the revenues and then tries to amend, to make an amendment to the anticipation. But the distinction is really whether there is a regulator and a certainty that it can collect the revenues that were anticipated or supposed to make the tariff be collected. I think that the most important distinction is the monopoly and certainty and the regulator and the decision is dealt during the morning is much less important for the identifying the regulated
So element of approach is matches the gas price adjustment actually when it comes to water cost in Korea. She accounts for more than 9% of our all costs. It costs over two parts. One is the normal price, the second one is adjustment price. The normal price is estimate cost, reflecting estimate cost and volumes for the next period based on budget. And the adjustment price is cost difference between actual amount and estimated amount. So this kind of adjustment is being made every year. So Korea's adjustment mechanism matches 100% of two element approach. But I think this kind of automatic approach is not being widely adopted in various industries otherwise. So I think we need to be more desirable to widen the scope of adjustment approach more widely.
Okay, Jane, just to clarify my understanding, we have two up mechanisms in our country for purchased energy, some transmission charge, but in 2001 there was a energy rationing there, and we had the right to compensate the loss in the revenue losses by the federal government, considering our concession contract. I remember that we recorded assets, regulatory assets, that were higher than 1 billion. My question is, this kind of event, do you think that it's included in this scope here? Yes, that's my...
I think with that sort of event, it sounds to me as though there was specific government regulation brought in to match a certain circumstance.
I had to negotiate, right? But it was in our concession contract, mm-hmm. the right to be compensated. But it's not a true-up mechanism. We had to go to the government and dialogue with them.
I mean, that sounds to me initially that that would be something that would be captured by existing IFRS, even that you then end up with a contractual right with the regulator, but certainly we'd need to think about it, but that's my gut reaction.
Okay.
I'm quite conscious of time. We've got quite a few people with their cards up. I don't know whether it's worth taking a 10-minute break now and coming back and finishing.
Okay.
On rather than rushing everything, but I appreciate it. It's 2 hours since we started, so it's obviously worth a quick 10-minute comfort break. Okay, welcome back. Jane and I have discussed this, and we think that this is such a critical part of the project that we're just going to let this conversation roll, and if we have to cut something, it'll be later in the afternoon. And so we'd like to go to the people on the phones now and see if they've been raising their hands. With apologies to them for not seeing it.
Thanks. Yeah, it's totally utter. Look, I think many of the examples that I've heard today, including the upfront capital costs or the agreed recruitment of costs that are covered by some arrangement with the regulator, to me. I think some of the discussion has been around that a lot of those seem to be already covered by existing accounting standards, but again, I think similar to some of the other discussions that I've heard, and I think what Sherm raised before, that if there's a distinguishing feature, it is around the true-up of costs incurred in the past that will be recouped in the future, but subject to a future event still to take place, which is the agreement by the regulator. And I acknowledge that there are deviations to that, and there is maybe an incentive or revenue part to that, and it's just not cost. But I think largely, to me, that true-up element is quite different and not covered by anything else, whereas I can see a lot of, as I said, the capital costs and other similar type arrangements already being somewhere within the existing accounting standard coverage.
Thanks, John. Sherm or Brian, do you want to come in?
Oh, sure. Can you hear me out there?
Yeah, we can.
Hello. Oh, I'm glad to be here. I think what we were thinking about here, the discussion captures a lot of the things, especially in the agenda paper 2, that we were concerned about. And I do think additional clarity around what the single element means would be quite helpful because of the regulations in the United States. But also we focused on, I don't know what we call this, paragraph 10 or item 10. And without being too redundant, I do think the true up is a cost recovery mechanism. I heard about a lot of the specific examples, and one of the things I just want to point out, as we stressed through our last meeting, that the regulatory compact in the United States is very, very strong. So there are elements of cost that had not been anticipated. Sometimes when the rate is set, that occurs in between a rate period that the regulator would allow for recovery. And we do think that creates the type of right that will give recognition to a regulatory asset in this particular instance. The other thing that I think we see here in the United States is sometimes the regulator will want to smooth the effect or the rate shock on a particular customer or customer class or those who pay in the bills. And in those particular cases, regulatory assets are also permitted. So I think the discussion kind of captured some of these points, but I just wanted to discuss it more from a macro level. And the paper seemed to, they gave good advice on how to strengthen the paper, but I do think we're going in the right direction. And that's all I have to say.
Thanks, Brian. Okay. Thanks. So, and I will apologise, I've lost track of whose card went up first, so perhaps we'll just work the room if that's okay. And Jakob?
I've got two points. So one is, Ricky just mentioned about funding. And South Africa, the funding element is included in the research. Now, as a result of that, if you're over or under, there's going to be no adjustment. The other question that I have, it's about cross-subsidization. In South Africa, you will find that the poorer customers, if they use not much of electricity, they will get it at a cheaper rate. But the more kilowatt, for example, you use, the more expensive it will become. So in terms of classes, there will be some discrimination.
Right. So in terms of you're looking at the features and saying it's a non-discriminatory, so yeah, that's a good point. We perhaps need the clarity because we're certainly not intending to exclude having different classes. So thank you.
Yeah. I think that's covered by your flexible pricing discussion. In
I
the
think
papers.
That's where we were trying to go, but yeah, we perhaps need more clarity to capture that.
I'm referring back again to the single versus dual element, just for clarity. It, you know, if we refer to page paragraph 35 and 36 in the paper, where the BAP analysis is around the distinction between the two, I would just offer that, you know, the vast majority of regulatory framework in North America, to me, sounds very, very similar to the single element. And so if the intention was to exclude that from scope, I think that would be, to us, maybe a little counterproductive for the whole initiative here, but, you know, for the most part, you don't have a true-up mechanism, and if you happen to over-earn a little bit compared to what was in the original expected number that created the tariff to begin with, if you happen to over-earn a little around that or under-earn around that, you don't true that up going forward. However, if you over-earn dramatically or under-earn dramatically under the regulatory compact, either party has a right. The commission can call you in and change your rate, or you can go to the commission and seek relief by raising your rate. And that, to me, is the crux of the scope. Should be, do you have legally enforceable rights and obligations created by the regulator? And I don't think the distinction is a true-up mechanism or no true-up mechanism. To be in scope. So that, to me, that was my biggest concern. And again, a market participant in a competitive market, they don't have a legal right to raise their prices. There's no legally enforceable. You're right that they can go and raise their price when their cost goes up, but if everybody else stays at the lower price, they go out of business. There's no legally enforceable right for them to charge a customer. So I don't... To me, the logic doesn't flow for me in terms of how we're distinguishing adjustment factor, no adjustment factor, and that's the key critical factor. I think, to me, it all comes back to, do you have a legal right or obligation? And that's what puts you in scope or not in scope.
Yeah.
Can I
just... Sorry, go ahead, Karen.
I do very much agree with what Duane just said, and I'm getting very, I guess I'm not, I'm very uncomfortable with this focus on features of regulation because every jurisdiction
state by state, province by province, or country by country will have different features. And so I want to reiterate what Duane just said about there is a compact with the regulator, and it will create rights and obligations. And there is an infinite variety of these, the terms and conditions, if I could put it that way, that govern the commercial operation of the entity itself, how much it can charge, and so on. But there's a couple of distinguishing features. Duane touched on them. The first is that it creates the regulator and the relationship creates a set of legal rights and obligations. And part of that, the regulator will have the ability to influence timing of new assets, variances in expected costs, and the introduction of new assets to rate base. So it's quite, the regulator has timing ability and it creates rights and obligations. And so we can talk ad nauseum about whether in one jurisdiction or another they've got to true up a past cost and future rates, or whether there's off-ramps or so on. But what is important, and Duane has said, is that it creates rights and obligations, and they're legally enforceable and they bind customers. The second is that the regulator has usually considerable latitude to shape the timing of incurred costs and expected future costs, because, again, rates are generally speaking set prospectively, but they can recover variances and other issues arising in the past. It's all part of that agreement or compact. So I really don't want to get too stuck on what the details of each regulatory arrangement are, but they create legal rights and obligations, and they are enforceable, and they often create timing, which is why we get these rate-regulated assets and liabilities from both sources.
Thanks, Karen. I mean, I absolutely agree with that, and what we're trying to focus on are the rights and obligations. What we're trying to do in this project, though, is identify some the types of rights and obligations that commonly arise, because, as I think we all agreed back in July, we can't write accounting standards to deal with however million different types of rate regulation there might be around the world. So part of the process that we're trying to go through here is to try and identify a way that we can describe the rights and obligations that are common. They may have slightly different practical applications, but it's trying to identify some principles that we can latch onto, and if we're going to develop some guidance, we've got to have some sort of framework that we can apply that guidance to. So I think this is a useful conversation to try and articulate the types of rights and what obligations that we're talking about here. But yeah, definitely take your point, Karen.
I mean, I want to come back to what Richard said. So even if certain things are an expense or capital item, the regulator can say, well, in normal IFRS or US GAAP or Canadian CGAAP, you would normally recognize the expense one way, but we're going to tell you to recognize it a different way. And you're going to include different things in that number, and then you're going to carry on. And so try and devise a standard that's going to capture all of these things is going to be extremely difficult, I guess is my point. So again, you think in some respects we almost have to be higher level to say, and really I'm asking you the question, why is it not sufficient to say that the presence of a regulator or something that has the authority to set binding rates, isn't that sufficient enough to say, regardless of whether it's you can identify the tool that's used across jurisdictions the same way, isn't it sufficient to say there is someone who has the authority to bind you, they're enforceable, and they bind customers? Isn't that enough for the standard? Do we actually have to get into the gritty detail and try and identify the broad categories, because we're not going to be able to anticipate everything?
I guess that's a good question, and I'm possibly not the best person to answer that question, but I'll have a go anyway. And I'll look to the board members sitting around the room to give me some help in the meantime. We have to balance two things. We have to remember that as a standard-setting organisation, we have our conceptual framework to deal with. And I know that we said earlier this morning this group is not to focus on the conceptual framework, because that's what the board and the Accounting Standards Advisory Forum are there to help us with. But we have a remit, which is
to try and set accounting standards that provide information that's relevant and useful to users of the financial statements. If we've got certain primary users of financial statements that we talked about back in July, being the investors, the lenders, potential investors, lenders, etc. And I think we're trying to get a balance here between saying, well, we're trying to capture what it is the rate regulation is trying to achieve, but we can't just give carte blanche to rate regulators to set the accounting standards, which is almost, I think, Karen, it's almost an implication of what you're saying, that it's almost if the regulator says this is okay, then that's what we end up reporting. We've got to strike a balance between trying to match up what the regulator says and what the regulation is achieving and what is realistic for us to capture within financial statements.
I guess my only response to that is, again, based on just what I've seen them do, they'll take the general standard and then they'll tweak it in a manner that's consistent with good rate-making practices. But, again, go back to the statutory latitude of the regulator, at least in Ontario, they can use any method or device. So they have considerable latitude to say, we see what IFRS says, we see what US GAAP says, but we have different needs in this jurisdiction, and we're going to tell you to do it that way. So the reality is they are very respectful of the accounting standards and what the goals are of accounting, but they will, within their power, and if there is a need to do so, tweak it. And it's not. And what I'm hearing from the various comments around the table is that they are, in fact, changing the accounting to very material items, notwithstanding what the IFRS standards or GAAP standards would be. And so that my only point is they are already setting the accounting standards, whether it's US GAAP to a certain extent or CGAAP as it used to exist or IFRS.
Karen, if I could say maybe a slightly different way, they are creating economic reality. So it's not they're setting the accounting, but by the way they're doing their record keeping, I mean, it creates the economic reality for that reporting entity. And so then all we're trying to do here is have the accounting best reflect the true economics of the business. And so I wouldn't look at it that somehow a regulator is dictating accounting. I think I look at it more to your point. We need to make sure we have useful, relevant statements. And we know regulators can dramatically affect the economics of an entity, and we're trying to have an accounting framework that is responsive to that.
Sherm Myers here.
Go ahead, Sherm.
I'd like to jump in and second that. As an analyst and looking at financial statements, the reflection of economic reality in the accounting is key. If the accounting didn't reflect the economic reality created by a rate regulator, we would want to recreate that in our analysis by making adjustments to the financial statements. So I agree 100% with what was just said.
Hello, this is Brian. I guess I have to pile on and say I agree too. But the other thing I think in looking at numbers 35 and 36, if this goes forth just like that, it doesn't even talk about the economic aspect of regulation and that integration with the accounting and the rate model. So maybe in some of the analysis, if we could bring some of that out, that the discussion can kind of go down that trail. So I agree with Duane and both the analysts, too, on that point.
Okay. Thanks, Brian. Yeah. I think this what we're trying to get at with every paragraph 35 is particularly, is it just something like a price cap type of mechanism where the regulation is just to cap the price. The economic reality of almost is you report exactly what it is that you earned during that period, so, because there is no adjustment, there's no way of changing the amount of revenue, or it's not changing the timing of anything, it's just saying this is the amount that you can charge maximum, and that type of regulation is normally a per item. If it's the type of regulation that says this is the maximum amount you can earn during the period, which is the thought that Michael's mentioned earlier, then I think that is a different type of adjustment. It's not a price cap type of adjustment. It's more nuanced than that, and I think that perhaps is what we need to spend more time, certainly in the discussion paper, is drawing out these nuances. What sort of economic impact does the regulation have? Is it something that's an immediate impact and therefore is reflected by existing accounting and financial reporting, or is it something that is focusing very much on timing differences, in which case we need to look at shifting revenue from one period to another period? I don't know if that helps summarise in a very short way something that's a very complex situation.
Okay, thank you. I think you have mentioned before the distinction between the single element adjustment and the dual element adjustment. You say normally single element adjustment is something that another company that is not related can apply, and I don't see that position, because the problem of a regulated activity is they cannot make that adjustment if there is not an agreement with the regulator. And I give you an example here in the UK with the British Airport. There's a discussion, you can remember there was a very big snow event and the Heathrow Airport was closed for 3 or 4 days. And this, now in the new regulation, there has been a discussion about how many snow events do you include in the OPEX in order to calculate the maximum rate you're applying. And the operator of the airport has not the decision to increase the tariff. It's a question of the regulator. So, in the case, for example, of this type of regulation, we are in the single element, nor in the dual element, because if you have more expenses due to, for example, a special snow event, you don't have right to recover that cash. But after 5 years, you have to discuss how many snow events I'm going to include. Take in mind that in the past, we consider only one and we have had three. So probably we have to discuss about three. So I think if you are in single element or you are in dual element, you are in a regulated framework. So I don't see that the single or dual element is the key issue to fix the scope of the project. And I would like also to use an example about if we go to the dual element and we go talk to the trap mechanism, that as I explained before, there are different types of trap mechanism. So, and probably I agree with Duane and say this, probably you have to analyze which is the right you have rather than to explain a specific type of mechanism. And let me give you an example, if it's a real example. It's a We were the owners of, we developed the main toll road in Chile. Mm-hmm. You know that Chile is a very long piece of earth. And there is a big toll road that is coming from Santiago to the south. It's 600, 700 kilometers. And this is a toll road that we began to build in the middle of the 90s. And there was an investment and there was a concession arrangement with tariffs that were fixed by the government according with all the conditions I have tried to explain here. And let me now go to the right, to the economic and financial balance of the concession. That is a type of right that you are explaining. According with that right, they say if there is a very impact in the economy of Chile, that is impacting the economics of the project, you will have right to receive that compensation. So that happened in the early years of the second of this century, that was an economic crisis in Chile, and there was a reduction of the traffic. And according to this right, finally, it was decided, and it's related with something that you mentioned, the compensation was not increasing the tariff. The compensation said, no, we are increasing the period of the concession. And it's very interesting to say, the concession period will finish when you obtain an expression value of revenues that is this amount. We have, so in order to calculate which is the profitability, you say the net present value of revenues you have to obtain is this amount. Suppose 100 million. So the day you obtain the net present value of 100 million, the day you finish the concession. So the question, how do you recognize this in your financial statements of the company? No, this is a true adjustment according with it being discussed here. Probably no, but it's a right, it's a very clear right that the company has to collect money, and the concession ends when this is sustained. And also an example that is has been also mentioned here is in this toll road we have also an earthquake. Do you remember that it 4 or 5 years ago or 6 years, a big, very big earthquake in near Santiago de Chile, and we had problems of some bridges were broken, but in this case the insurance contract was covering this risk. So the cost of that insurance contract was included in the tariffs that were fixed in Italy. So in that case we don't have any compensation because we're covered by an expense that was included in the initial project. So this comes also to my concern. That, for example, in the case in this example of the Chilean toll road, I will apply regulatory accounting only for the deviations that have been compensated with the increase of the period of the concession, or do I have to consider this as a whole because finally this is a rate of activity? So.
Yeah.
That's the point.
I mean, I think there's some good points in there, and again, it's, I think, around the clarity of how we're describing. It sounds to me as though we need to be moving away from the description of single element versus dual elements, and I don't know what terminology we can come up with, but we always try and come up with some shorthand terminology to describe very complex things, because otherwise all of our meetings will last 15 days just to describe what we're talking about. But yeah, I take those points, hey Susan. And as your last one there about the insurance, obviously if you have the earthquake event happening, your insurance cover kicks in, and you may be recognising rights attached to that, which is not going to be reflected in your tariff because the government know you've already been compensated through your insurance. But in substance, if the regulator is saying that you're not covered by the insurance, but we will make sure you have an equivalent right using a different mechanism, then you're quite right.
This is the example that Richard mentioned. I understand you mentioned that in UK the stones are not covered by the insurance, no? Other stones. But in this case of the earthquake, I don't know why, but it was covered by the insurance.
Yeah.
Was covered.
Yes, it was covered. Yes.
Is it still covered?
I don't know, we saw 2 years ago the local country to Colombian investors. Because due to the contract, the negotiation of the contract of the extension, it was a very good asset, and we decided to divest this project.
Thank you.
Well, assuming that we're going to stick with the true-up adjustment, which is not clear to me any longer, I still would like to make a statement. In Canada, the majority of the regulatory assets and liabilities that are not embedded in the PP&E relate to the what you call on page 4, the timing differences between the amounts recognized for financial reporting purposes and those recognized for regulatory purposes. They do not relate to what you have budgeted in terms of cost and what you have recovered. So I would say it's probably 80 to 90% in certain utilities that relate to timing differences, the cash difference. In fact, it's cash accounting versus accrual accounting for pension, taxes, and ARO. So the page 4 talks about that. When I look at the definition or the conclusion that you reach on paragraph 38, you talk about the true adjustments to be made for the differences between estimated and actual amounts for previous periods. Does it really cover here what we're talking about, the timing difference? No, it does not. And I believe it. As I said, this is the largest amount.
Yeah, I think it is.
You said it is a number of times,
yeah.
But when I read that, it's not. You may want to.
I think it is the clarity of the terminology. I mean, in terms of the estimated amount versus the actual amount, the estimated amount you can read as being the accounting amount versus the actual amount being the price paid. And I guess it is a terminology between maybe expenses incurred versus expenses paid. So that would be captured. But you're right, it's a clarity of the terminology, and we obviously need to work harder at trying to get the descriptor to capture what I think we're all trying to talk about the same thing.
but it's just the terminology we use in practice confusing it. If that is on agenda paper 2, or would anybody else like to add anything? I'm conscious of people on the phone as well. Apologies for keep getting you earlier, but we'll give you the chance now and Karen on the video. Do you want to add anything before we move on?
Nothing from me, no.
Thanks, guys.